Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. Dr. John Vial is writing another book, big surprise, right? We have two books to talk to you about, one about a founding father of the country, and one about a founding father of John Vial. James Madison, philosopher, founder, and statesman, was co-edited by John Vial with William Peterson and Frank J. Williams, and it is a collection of scholarly perspectives on the former president of the United States and father of the Constitution, as he is popularly referred to. The second book we will get to in due course, it is Proverbs from the Poet, Preacher, Quips, Quibbles, and Quotes from Ralph Vial, John's father, and John put that collection together and bound it for popular reading and consumption with a bent toward faith and spirituality, but not exclusively, and we will get to that in a moment. First, with regard to the James Madison book, how much of the early Constitution can be attributed to James Madison, first in content and then secondly in tone?
If I may, let me tell him just a little bit about the publication of this, because it's published by Ohio University Press. It's the first time that I've done a book with them, but they've done a very good job.
And it's a collection of a variety of scholars' writings.
It is, and it actually came out of a conference that was held at Louisiana State University in Shreveport by my friend Bill Peterson, who is one of the co-editors here. He has meetings down there about every two or three years, and this is either the third one that I've been to. And it focused specifically on Madison, and so we took the best papers from that and put them into a book. But in answer to your specific question, and actually, if you notice in the book, I actually have two essays in here, and one is on whether Madison is appropriately designated as father of the Constitution, and then the other is on his response to the Alien and Sedition Acts and sort of his view on free speech.
And I have a question on that later on,
sure,
too.
Sure. But in regards to the Constitution, there were 55, and you know I've done an encyclopedia of the Constitutional Convention, so I already knew a little bit about this, but there were 55 different men from 12 states who attended the Constitutional Convention in the summer of 1787, and almost every commentator who has seriously examined the convention concludes that Madison was in the top four or five. Now, he's often called the father of the Constitution because he's believed to have been the chief influence behind the Virginia Plan, which was the large state plan that was introduced at the beginning of the convention and seems to have been the most influential. But it's really, you know, it's a stretch to call anybody there were fathers of the Constitution. There wasn't a single founding father. But he certainly deserves as much credit as anyone would.
And Alan Gibson, who's one of the scholars who writes in here, debates Madison's role. He quotes other scholars and posits that Madison's ideas basically were too original to have carried the day in debate at the time. So the argument of big government specifically, where all kinds of factions can fight it out versus the small government or small nation theory posited by Montesquieu.
Well, Gibson there is referring, when we talk about Madison, you have pre-convention, Madison probably did more than anyone at the convention. At the convention itself, he often got outvoted, but the plan that he seems to have had the most impact in also seems to have been the one that most impacted the convention. But then, of course, after the convention, Madison, well, the lead author of the Federalist Papers was Alexander Hamilton, but most people think that the most impressive essays were written by James Madison. And one of those essays posits, in contradistinction to Montesquieu, that a country spread over a large area will be better able to promote justice and oppose factions. And I think what Gibson is arguing is it's not so certain that that particular argument, which is primarily found in Federalist Number 10, was as recognized or as understood back in 1787-88 as it is loved by political scientists of today.
Well, it's sort of a backhanded compliment in saying that Madison was ahead of his time.
I think so. And part, you know, part of the question is just, you know, we have documents that we look back and say, and particularly the Federalists, you know, well, this is the greatest thing that was probably written on the Constitution. Did everybody know that at the time? Well, probably not. They were reading newspapers. You know, there were all kinds of other influences on them. And so what we look back on in the calm light of reason probably had a place for them, but it may not have had quite as important a place as we sometimes say that it did.
In one of your own writings, you talk about the geek factor with regard to Madison.
Madison was something of a geek, and that's probably why I enjoy portraying him.
Now, if he was alive today, well, let me explain that last reference. Sometimes you and Mr. Madison share the same clothing.
We do, usually around Constitution Day or We the People events. I like to dress up as James Madison, yes.
Okay. Since you have labeled him a geek, if he were alive today, would he be called a policy wonk?
Perhaps. He may very well be a university professor rather than a president. And this incidentally has also been said of Jefferson, that he did have some charisma about him, but he wasn't a particularly effective public speaker. He liked small social settings, but he did not particularly like large crowds. And it's not altogether clear that he would be a very good campaigner today. So he may very well be, you know, the kind of person that WMOT would call for a comment on the inauguration rather than actually being in the inauguration.
Or if he were in a government setting, perhaps he would be a part of the brain trust rather than the man at the press conference who answers the questions.
That's quite possible. And actually, you know, if there was one weakness of James Madison, and we all have them, but probably the weakest part of his career was his presidency. He did not turn out to be, well, in some ways he was a good leader. He respected civil liberties. The nation did win in the War of 1812, but he was fairly unpopular during much of the war. He was unable to, till the end, really to choose very good leaders, and he had a lot of faults there. So He was among the more cerebral of the Founding Fathers.
One of the entries in this book, and allow me to give credit to the authors, Byron W. Daines and Mark P. Hopkins, is titled James Madison, Brilliant Theorist, Failed Tactician. Do you agree or disagree?
Well, I can't remember. I think we had discussion when we did this as to whether we were going to put a question mark after that.
There is no question mark after it.
Okay. I think to some degree that is true. I mean, I think his presidency was not his high point, other than he was able to prosecute the war without going after political opponents. And that's something that John Adams was not as good as doing when he was president.
Adams could hold a grudge like nobody's business.
He could, and I'm not sure that Adams was as adamant about the sedition acts as some of the other Federalists were. But certainly he allowed it, you know, he allowed it to be adopted in a way that Madison did not push for or favor suppression of his own political enemies.
On to the Alien and Sedition Acts. You wrote an entry in this book called James Madison's Report of 1800, The First Amendment, Freedom of the Press, and Common Law. With regard to especially the First Amendment, if Madison were alive today, would he be referred to as a strict constructionist? That is to say, it says what it says, and you can't read anything into it beyond what the words say. Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of the press.
The problem with strict construction of the First Amendment is it doesn't actually take you nearly as far as we've gone. Because if you limit the words to Congress, then it would permit states to enact all kinds of laws that Congress couldn't. So he might be, you know, Justice Black is someone who argued that you should interpret, really in favoring strict construction, Black favored fairly broad construction of the First Amendment, which included application to the states via the 14th Amendment. Now, Madison didn't have the 14th Amendment, but we do know that one of his biggest disappointments was that Madison actually wanted a provision in the Bill of Rights that would have limited the ability of the states on matters of individual conscience, which presumably would have included freedom of speech and press. So he would be characterized as fairly liberal on the issue of freedom of speech. He believed not only that it should apply to Congress, but he seems to suggest that even it would be best at the states that they allow, you know, fairly far-ranging opposition, particularly to political figures or what we today might call public figures.
Are you saying then that in that respect he actually anticipated part of the spirit of part of the 14th Amendment?
Oh, I think he definitely did. I mean, Madison actually often expressed greater concern over state deprivations of civil liberties than he did over federal deprivations.
I wonder why that didn't make it into the Bill of Rights.
Well, because he was ahead of his time there. States were very jealous of their own powers, and I think they were particularly fearful about, as Madison himself was on other occasions, about giving too much power to federal courts over state jurisdictions.
When it comes to these periodic lists, and sometimes historians participate in them, and sometimes they just say this is too inane, it does not take the march of time, the progress of technology and other variances into consideration. But these periodic lists of who the greatest top 10 presidents of all time are, does Madison make the top 10 time after time?
No. Now, Thomas Jefferson does, and we do need to remember that James Madison was Secretary of State under Jefferson, and that's the period when the Louisiana Purchase was made. So at least to some degree, I think you ought to get a little bit of the credit for that. But no, he does. James K. Polk from Tennessee usually makes the top 10. Jefferson, Washington, Lincoln.
When it comes to serious scholars, you mean Polk makes the top 10. When it comes to the public at large, maybe not so much so. They might not be as familiar with
Polk. Well, that's true. That's true. But when you include the historians, he's often up there. Yes.
Yeah. How can someone who has been dubbed the father of the Constitution not make the top 10?
Well, he would make the if you were asking who are the top 10 of the founding fathers, he might make the top 10. If you're asking who the top 10 presidents were, then as president, he was not as impressive as he was. You know, in some ways, the high point of Madison's life was at the age of 36 when he was at the Constitutional Convention. I don't want to say it was all downhill from there. But, well, and then the other high point would be the work that he did, you know, within the next 2 years for ratification of the Bill of Rights. It's more accurate to call Madison the father of the Bill of Rights than it is to call him the father of the Constitution.
In fairness to Mr. Madison, it should be pointed out it's terribly difficult to get any work done when the British are setting your house on fire.
Well, and of course, some people held him responsible for him letting his house be on fire. But, you know, Dolly does get a little bit of credit during this time. She saved Gilbert Stuart's portrait of Washington. And, you know, to Madison's credit, he remains surprisingly calm. And if I recall correctly, he is the only president who, during his administration, actually went out on the field of battle and, you know, surveyed what was going on and offered to help. I think they eventually moved him along.
Oh, that sounds so much like Alexander Haig saying, "I'm in charge."
Well, no, oh, no, no. He was actually commander-in-chief at the time, Mr. Madison, so
yeah,
he had a right to be there.
He certainly did, but he was a civilian commander-in-chief.
Again, I mean,
did he know anything about military strategy and tactics?
No, not a lot. He had a couple dueling pistols with him, as I recall.
Yeah, okay.
Although he actually had proved
Aaron
more,
Burr gave them to him for Christmas, right?
He was actually more prescient about the threat to Washington, D.C. than his own commanders. He had been telling his commanders, "We've got to do something," and they said, "Oh, no, the British would never come here." So he actually proved more accurate than they had been.
Now, how did Madison have better intelligence than his own military?
I'm not sure, but he did.
I don't mean intelligence in terms of brains.
Sure.
I mean intelligence in terms of reconnaissance.
Well, partly it goes to one of the reasons he's not rated very high as president, which was he did not always choose very good subordinates, and in this case, the subordinate he chose was somewhat daft, to be truthful.
Was he a delegator, or was he a micromanager who liked to take a hands-on approach?
I think as a president, he was more of a delegator, and sometimes it worked. Where it worked very well was at the end of the administration, where he made James Monroe his Secretary of State. And Monroe, for a time, was actually serving, as I recall, as both Secretary of State and Secretary of War. He was a very adept administrator, and, you know, Madison let him take the reins, and he did well with it.
Okay. The book, once again, is James Madison, Philosopher, Founder, and Statesman, edited by John R. Vial, William D. Peterson, and Frank J. Williams from Ohio University Press. Go to ohioswallow.com. Ohioswallow.com.
And it is both in hardback and paperback, so it's relatively reasonable in terms of price.
I'd say so. Speaking of relatively reasonable, Proverbs from the Poet, we move on to the book about which this is actually the second book, which is a compilation of sayings from your father, Ralph Vial, Proverbs from the Poet, Preacher, Quips, Quibbles, and Quotes. And these are more collections of aphorisms. The first book was really poems.
There are actually two books that I have out. The first is called We Are His Poets, and I'm hoping that will be the first of probably six volumes I think I've compiled so far of poetry that my dad did throughout his life. And then I did a smaller book called Let the Bells Ring Out on Christmas Morning, which was a selection from all the poems that I've gone through so far, over 2,000, and we picked out about 100 poems that dealt specifically with Christmas.
What most of these proverbs are one-liners, not all of
they
them,
are.
but most of them. Were you able to ascertain which of these were Ralph Vial originals and which were either borrowed, revamped, historical, or passed down through the generations?
Right. I think he intended for all of them to be original. He's really a stickler about plagiarism.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple times where he'll say, at the bottom, his notes will say, you know, I took this while listening to so-and-so's preacher or suggested by. But these were actually collected over a 50-year period. There's about 2,500 of them. And, you know, I knew, Dad had told me a long time ago that he wanted me to publish his poetry, and I knew he had done poems. I honestly didn't know till 2 or 3 years ago that he had even collected the Proverbs. And so as I was going through the other, I found this volume and said, you know, well, what's this? And it's like, well, these are Proverbs that he had written basically over a lifetime. They cover about a 50-year period. And there are some that are sort of obvious takeoffs on popular Proverbs where he'll turn a word around or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, you know, I would say 90% or better certainly he thought were original to him.
As you compiled these, did you run across ones which you can recall him saying to you and your siblings as a child as to give you some sort of guidance or instruction on how to comport yourselves?
I really don't. I mean, I can recognize them as sort of vintage Dad as I read them. They're kind of the things that I would expect him to say. But again, I didn't even know he had the collection. And most people who knew that he had poetry, to my knowledge, didn't know that he was doing this. I'm wondering if I'm eventually going to hit Ecclesiastes, since I've now done, you know, some poems and sort of the Psalms and the Proverbs. And I don't know if he has another volume waiting out there for me or not.
So when your dad gave you advice as a kid, he didn't phrase it in the form of a proverb. It
No.
was more direct and to the point.
That's
than
right.
that.
I mean, I think he's a generally pretty wise man. He gave me some good advice. But again, if you had said, well, is there a collection of these? I would have said, well, not to my knowledge.
Okay. There is a section on the church, and he's a devoutly religious man, obviously, but he does not let the church off the hook in these proverbs.
No,
he kicks the church's butt with some with some pretty.
I don't think he would phrase it that way.
No, he probably wouldn't. But he some interesting reminders in here. Explain this one to me. Not only does the grass look greener on the other side of the fence, but a church looks whiter in another town. What does that mean?
I don't think it's race, if that's what you're asking. I think it refers to purity, that we always sort of look at another church and think, you know, oh, if we could, you know, they have it better. Their people never get in the same kind of trouble that our people do, that sort of thing. I think that's what he means.
The expression, let George do it, must have originated in church.
Right. It's, you know, pastors will tell you that, what is it, 90% of the giving is done by 10% of the people, and it's either 10 or 20% of the people do 90% of the work of the church. And I think he's just pointing to that phenomenon.
I didn't think about the donations of money when I read that. I thought about committees and fellowship.
No, that's what
and
I'm
that
saying.
Kind of
I'm just making a parallel that just as, you know, a small percentage usually gives a large percentage of the money, mm-hmm. same thing with service and committees and teaching Sunday school and singing in the choir and those kind of things.
People will support the church's activities as long as they aren't asked to participate. Again, along those yes. same lines with yes. the same theme. It must have irked him as someone who participates. Did he feel that a great deal of the work of the church was left to him and people like him? And
I think he did what he did because he enjoyed it. And you know, my mother has long played the piano and been a church clerk and done things. So I don't think it's that. I think, you know, Dad actually started. He spent most of his life as a teacher, but he started as a missionary and had done some preaching. And I think any preacher will have days where they get frustrated that, you know, it doesn't seem, you know, people seem to be willing to come to the church luncheons and to listen to the pretty music, but sometimes they don't really want to seem to be part of it.
The church has turned from being martyrs today to being scholars. It's safer this way. As a scholar, do you feel offended?
I don't, but one of the things that I thought was really fascinating about Dad's book is how many times he felt that modern seminaries had let the church down, that people went to seminary and instead of strengthening their faith, they ended up losing it. And I think that there, I won't call it an anti-intellectualism. You know, Dad has a master's degree. He taught school his entire life. He's obviously very committed to scholarly, you know, he has many sections in there on how he loves books and, you know, he writes poetry. But I think he's very concerned that sometimes we over-intellectualize faith. And instead of, you know, building people up when we're giving them theological education, we end up raising more doubts in their mind than we do actually commissioning them to, you know, do the Lord's work, if you will.
And then conversely, non-believers who look at the church from the outside think that there is far too big a chasm between intellect and religion. And
some... Well, that's the other side of it. And again, I really think that Dad is cognizant of both. I think, you know, a lot of this comes out of his own personal experience. He'd been to some seminaries, and I think in some he just felt like they were talking about everything other than the Bible, and in others he felt a little bit more comfortable.
Denominationalism. People can be saved in spite of religion. So he was pro-church, but he was not pro-organization or pro-religious bureaucracy.
Well, I mean, he was a devoted member and continues to be a devoted member of a church. And mm-hmm. so he's, you know, he would not favor disorganized religion. Mm-hmm. You know, when people say that post-organized religion, you sometimes don't know what they mean. But, you know, he recognizes, I think, that, you know, denominations are good. We need to be a part of something. But we need to recognize that the gospel is greater than any single denomination, any single articulation of, you know, what we think that the gospel truly is.
He says, those who condemn denominations, in fact, are themselves following the beliefs of some leader. He's pointing up the hypocrisy of people who condemn a denomination or a sect that has a particular ideology and has established that as policy, because each and every one of us has some kind of creed that we believe, whether
That's right.
we picked it up from a denomination or not.
Sure. And, you know, Dad believes, you know, very strongly in the inerrancy of the Bible. And, of course, a lot of denominations do. And I guess one of the great frustrations is, you know, so often we turn to the same Bible and we come up with different interpretations. And, you know, a lot of that, I think he would tell us to major on the majors, that often we major on things that are perhaps not as fundamental.
God's predestination is a potential promise that becomes operative at one's reception of Christ. In other words, you have to accept Christ as your personal Savior before you can even get a chance at knocking on the pearly gates.
I'm not sure he would phrase it exactly that way, but during his life, there were a couple people in the church and elsewhere who came in as they were sort of predestinationists who believed that because you were predestined, you didn't need to do anything about it. And he reacted very strongly to that. He believes that, you know, yes, you can't be saved without God's calling, but God doesn't force anybody either. And that there's a, you know, almost an ineffable mixture of human will as well as divine ordination.
Does it irk him that some people see service to Christ is almost sort of a quid pro quo, I mean, or a business arrangement. Well, all right, I'll do these good works, and then you've got to pay off at the end.
He clearly does not believe that one is saved by works. He believes that works are a product of salvation rather than the prerequisite to salvation.
Okay. This is going to make everyone groan who has ever fallen asleep in church. Short songs, short sermons, short services, and short devotions produce short Christians.
Well, he might say the same about some of my sermons. I always think that you never convert anyone after 20 minutes. But I think what he's getting to a larger point that sometimes, you know, it's not so much the shortness of the service as it is, you know, somebody comes to church once a month or once a year, and they don't understand why they're not more spiritual than they are. And it's like it's like study. You're only going to get into it, you know, out of it what you put into it. And I think that's the larger point he's trying to make.
We could make the point to the elder Mr. Vile that people of his generation tend to have longer attention spans than those of us of
true.
The boob tube generation. And
I think that's true.
You've got to get them and get them quick if you're going to get them. These are aphorisms. It reminds me in a way of Tuesdays with Maury. Are you familiar with the book and the movie about?
I'm actually not. I mean, I think if you want to know what it's patterned on, most clearly, I think it is literally patterned on the book of Proverbs, mm-hmm. where you have, you know, hopefully wise sayings by an individual, in this case collected over a lifetime. And, you know, so readers will know I'm the one that sort of organized them into the topics. I just thought reading straight through 2,500 Proverbs might be a little tedious, and so I broke them down into, you know, comments on work or garage sales or church or wisdom or whatever it is.
It's interesting. There are three categories here that have relatively few Proverbs in them. Two of them have only one proverb each, and the
That's
other
not
only
the wisdom
has...
of his son, is it?
No. And one of them has only three proverbs each, and they are self-pity, selfishness, and sex.
I mean, it's really funny to do my dad's comments on sex, but one of them is something to the effect, what, that we all have it, but some of us control it better than others?
All have the attribute of sex, but some pay more attention to it than others.
Yes.
People don't need birth control pills as much as they need self-control pills.
And that's very much vintage dad, yes.
And many Christians are more concerned about their sex lives than their salvation.
And that's probably true.
It's probably
true
probably
of non-Christians
true.
As well.
One of these is just a quote from Romans. You quoted okay. Romans 15:2 here. Selfishness is the Christian's greatest sin.
Well, I think it's
that's not
it's,
a Ralph Vile original.
No, it's not a quotation, I believe. It's a summary of, I believe, what that verse says, mm-hmm. or it's what he reads, his sort of interpretation of the verse. I don't believe it's a direct quotation.
Do you find that the subjects on which he has the least number of proverbs to contribute are the subjects that are less indicative of him as a person? For example, if you don't have much to say about self-pity, you're probably not a terribly self-piteous person. Or if you don't have that many proverbs about selfishness, you're probably not a very selfish person.
Perhaps, and again, do understand that the categories are, they were not his categories, they were mine.
A creation of yours.
And actually, I look back on the one of them that I like the best is I put under wisdom, and it says something like, a lot of people have more, courage than sense. And I thought, well, that's pretty true.
That's the only category. Most people have more nerve than sense.
More nerve than sense.
That's the only proverb under the category of wisdom. And I remember joking to you at the time that it must have Rod Blagojevich's picture next to it.
Well, I don't think that it does, but it's not an illustrated book, but perhaps the next edition can be.
Well, you're going to have to be careful in the sex section then when you
okay,
get around to that.
We'll watch.
We'll watch on that. You think that really seriously you do have a third book out of your father, possibly? You've done
well, this
poems,
is the
you've
third.
Done Proverbs. This is the third?
Right.
I thought
words,
you had only one book of
no,
poems.
I have one book of poem of his first 225 poems, and I have another collection of his Christmas poems.
That's right.
And then, you know, I got about five or six more to go if we complete that series, then this book. And it, I don't know that I'll ever do it, but he also has a collection of devotionals, which would probably make a book of their own.
Ralph Vial is just as prolific as his son. He just doesn't know it.
Exactly. Exactly.
Dr. John Vial, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you.
This is MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, check us out at mtsunews.com and download the podcast at your leisure. And we're also available on iTunes.